1220 AM, W248DE, Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. Wildfires are burning across the western United States, dozens in Oregon alone. Here's CBS's Jonathan Vigliotti.
Here in California, you have about a dozen wildfires that are burning. Elsewhere, we're talking New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, and even Colorado have wildfires. So far this year, more than 3 million acres of land have been scorched by wildfires.
Delta Airlines is finally starting to steady itself days after a global computer outage caused chaos for the airline. Here's CBS's Chris Van Cleve.
The company president told a convention of business travelers the airline expects to be back to normal by Thursday or Friday.
In Wisconsin, Vice President Kamala Harris told a crowd of thousands she's ready to go head-to-head with former President Donald Trump.
In this campaign, I promise you, I will proudly put my record against his any day of the week.
CBS News Brief. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Join us live every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 5 to 6 p.m. for Playmakers, brought to you by Quality Plus Printing. Call in with your sports thoughts and feelings only on WFHR.
Civic Media News, I'm Ella Saff. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Vice President Kamala Harris says she's running a people-powered campaign to beat Donald Trump. Harris visited Milwaukee Tuesday to launch her presidential campaign, only 2 days after Joe Biden dropped out of the race.
So, friends, we have 105 days until Election Day, and in that time, we've got some work to do. But we're not afraid of hard work. We like hard work, don't we? And we will win this election.
Harris has already raised over $100,000 for her campaign since Sunday afternoon. The plane that crashed and killed two people near the EAA Air Venture in Oshkosh was privately owned and not a part of the air show. The cause of the crash on Monday is still under investigation, and the names of the deceased have not been released. Last year at Air Venture, two people died and two were injured in a mid-air collision during the air show. And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
To everyone making time for life's best moments, let our team member Sandy share how Culver's is serving up Celebration by the Scoop.
Our rich and creamy fresh frozen custard makes every day a little bit sweeter. Enjoying a handcrafted treat with all the ooey gooey toppings you love, now that's worth celebrating.
Come to Culver's and let us serve you a sweet treat to make every moment count. From Wisconsin with love, welcome to Delicious.
Culver's, 8th Street South, Wisconsin Rapids.
Locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. 24 hours. Kamala Harris raised, what, $100 million? Via Act Blue, the Democrats did. And understand, this is a major sign of unity. This is saying, look, when the money starts flowing, especially small donors, this is she's going to be the nominee. Now, I found it interesting that the Republicans, they really don't know what to do. Because understand, their whole shtick was going to be to attack Joe Biden for being old. You know, now understand, they've got an old candidate who says really crazy stuff, but it was going to be all about, you know, old. It'll be interesting to see if Democrats pivot towards old, if the mainstream corporate-controlled right-wing media goes, hey, we got an old guy, and starts pointing out his old. I wouldn't hold my breath, but I'm curious. Now, the initial attacks that I've seen from Republicans on Kamala Harris have been fairly, fairly cute. One being, she's weird. Yeah, she's weird. She laughs at inappropriate moments. She's weird. evidently too liberal, too. And again, this is what the right does. Every Democrat is always going to be the most liberal ever. You know, Barack Obama was the most liberal ever and yet governed as a moderate. Bill Clinton, the most liberal ever, was a moderate. Joe Biden, the most liberal ever, and fairly moderate. A little more liberal than Obama, but still working class Joe. But I'm watching some of the attacks develop and what we're going to hear from Republicans over the coming days. You know, the plastic straws. You're going to hear a lot about plastic straws and carbon taxes. I can hear about a lot about that. Maybe leaving there, bring stoves and light bulbs back for all we know. But they've also come out and said, you know, she's going to go after Trump's tax cuts and they're going to raise taxes on you, without looking themselves in the face and going, hey, but we got a tax plan that would just basically eviscerate the working class. They're going to throw out the whole, you know, she doesn't want you to eat hamburgers. I heard that. All the way down to, and again, that's the ridiculous stuff. But all the way down to the policy stuff that they are concerned about. You know, they want a national right to work law. Republicans have been talking about that for a while. Kamala and the Democrats want to ban that. It's not a good thing. It doesn't help working people. It hurts working people in every instance. So again, it's one of those which side are you on kind of scenarios. Kamala and the Democrats are on the, hey, no, we're not going to keep doing this. And Republicans are, no, we got to double, triple down. I also saw, one of the favorite things is I've actually seen the old J.D. Vance attack of calling her a child. What was that? A childless cat lady. Yeah, because she looks just like a cat lady. But like I said, I'm curious to see where they go. Now, the big question for me personally, and probably for you as well, if she is the nominee, and it looks like she's going to be, it looks like there's no one to stop her, who does she choose as her VP? I've said in the past, I look at those candidates, and what is that first major decision? I knew Al Gore was in trouble when he chose traitor Joe Lieberman. I knew Hillary was in trouble when she chose that guy from Virginia. I'm sure you don't remember his name was Tim Kaine. Not an exciting candidate, not somebody who brought any help to the ticket. Now there's talk, you know, Mark Kelly seems to be at the top. The governor of my state, Josh Shapiro's there. Roy Cooper from North Carolina. There are a lot of names. Gretchen Whitmer with an all-female ticket could be interesting. But I'm still going to go with I want Pete Buttigieg. Simply because I think he's an incredible debater. He's really fantastic on messaging and talking to people who might not absolutely agree. So that outreach, he could be that guy. He could be the guy to help bring some of that outreach. But for me, this will be important because, as I said, this is the first major test of a candidate's decision-making. And who's she going to pick? I've even heard someone throw out Oprah. And I got to be honest, Oprah, everyone gets a car kind of thing, maybe. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Do you think she's going to be the nominee? And who do you think she's going to pick for her running mate? And is it a big deal? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, as of Saturday, it was the messaging machine of the Republicans that the whole agenda was about pointing out how feeble and old Joe Biden is. And now that Joe Biden has stepped aside, what's that messaging going to be? Will they look inward and maybe at their old guy who, I got to tell you, that whole shark battery thing, I don't know how you don't let that be something you focus on. But we just saw the whole coronation, the political theater that was the RNC, and here to share some thoughts on, you know, how that was, and maybe where we go from here. I've asked our good friend Will Bunch to come talk with us. He's a national columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer. He was actually at the RNC, so we'll see what that was like. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, Rick, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So let's start first with the big coronation, the big pep rally, if you will. Any gut response? Any thoughts?
You know, it's not a political party anymore, Rick. It's a cult. You know, I've been going to conventions on and off since 1992, the first convention I ever saw on TV was, I saw some of the famous 1968 Chicago convention on TV when I was 9 years old. And, you know, the 70s, Reagan versus Ford, I watched all those conventions. And the thing is, those conventions had a purpose, right? You know, there were political disagreements that needed to be hashed out. There were serious, people took the party platforms, people used to take those things seriously, right? That they would have debates over, you know, the Vietnam War or an abortion plank or gay rights. You know, they would have these debates until 2 a.m. sometimes at some of these earlier conventions. And it really meant something. They had a roll call of the states and it was a big deal. And, you know, at this RNC in Milwaukee, all of that stuff that I just described, the platform, nominating the candidates, they did it all in like the first hour, maybe the first 90 minutes. And then that was it. And then, so what do you do for 4 days? Well, you sing to the glory of Donald Trump, right? You know, this whole event was a 4 day deification of Donald Trump. Nobody was getting up there nobody was talking policy. I mean, people were getting up there to talk about how God had saved Donald Trump from this assassination attempt, and that he was truly a blessed figure, and, you know, he was the one to lead America, and you know, and he's a great grandfather and a great dad, and, you know, and it was really kind of creepy. It was, you know, it was like what you'd expect to hear about some, you know, Eastern European dictator or something like that, you know, this kind of hero worship. And again, going back to old conventions, as you probably know, Rick, you know, it used to be the candidates didn't go at all. I think FDR in 1932 was the first one to show up on the last night and give an acceptance speech. And you know, for years, then they only did that. Then they would show up to accept the nomination. But, you know, Trump was there every night because he had to be the center of attention. Yeah. You know, he had to make this big entrance, you know, with this crazy bandage on his right ear. You know, to the music, and people are all pressing to the back of the arena to get a good view of them. They're holding up the iPhones. And, you know, it's really this, like, for these people, it's like a quasi religious moment. And I you know, as somebody who's not part of the cult and just watching this, I found it kind of horrifying, you know, that, you know, that these people would do anything for their dear leader. And we know from history that usually does not turn out well.
Yeah, I found it interesting that people were wearing the Band-Aid or the maxi pad or whatever it is they were putting on their ear. But it's not, you know, something that hasn't kind of happened in the past. I mean, I think back to 2004 when everyone was wearing the Purple Heart Band-Aids and carrying flip-flops with them everywhere. So props are something that they do. I just found it interesting that you know, one of the greatest talking points that Trump had was the fact that, look, real, honestly, truthfully, you know, someone wanted to kill him, and to trivialize it by wearing, you know, whatever that was on there, just, I don't know, or do you see that differently?
No, I kind of tend to agree with you, although I fully expected that. I was actually surprised that it really didn't take root till maybe the third night. I thought I thought the minute people saw that, they would be rushing out to the CVS to get their own bandages, because that's the mindset. It was nonstop hero worship, and there's no dissent is brooked at these things, right? It's all about people who used to be rivals or even enemies of Donald Trump. Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis are made to get up there, and it's kind of a ritual humiliation,
That is an excellent way to put it, a ritual humiliation.
It is.
That's the best way of looking at that.
Yeah, and again, that seemed very cult-like to me. I don't know if you or how many of the listeners out there remember the movie The Manchurian Candidate. Well, they made it twice, but I'm a fan of the original with Frank Sinatra. But these soldiers who were shot down over Manchuria during the Korean War are brainwashed, and they're particularly brainwashed to believe in the goodness of one of their comrades who's actually not a good guy. But whenever they're asked about this guy, they say that he's the kindest, bravest, warmest, most wonderful human being they've ever met in their life. And they all say the exact same words in the exact same way. But I felt like I was watching the Manchurian Candidate up there with the way that these people talked about Donald Trump. I mean, it was just speech after speech, of this format of praising Trump. The only deviation, and this actually, I think, plays into the other thing that we want to talk about, tonight, about what's going on with Biden and Harris and the Democrats, is, there was this hour every night at the convention given over to, quote, ordinary people, unquote, and who almost all of these ordinary people were, all of them really, were people who had a story that they would claim, ridiculously in some cases, but they would claim that Joe Biden was somehow responsible for the death or the rape or the dismemberment or the drug overdose or something horrible that happened to their child or their sister or their family member. Joe Biden's fecklessness, killed my son in Afghanistan. It just went on and on. And of course, now a week later, all that testimony is kind of useless, right? Because Joe Biden is no longer the candidate. But it was interesting. I mean, it's certainly, this alleged kinder, gentler tone that they were supposed to adopt, which I never saw. I never saw it.
And a pro-worker tone. I mean, because, my Teamsters union, the general president, Sean O'Brien, was there to give what, look, two-thirds of the speech were things that I say on this program every single night. But the third of it was, for me, just the part that I struggle with. What were you there for that? And what was the tone, do you think? And how was it received?
Yeah, that was on Monday, the first night. And I had kind of a credentials glitch. And I was also covering this Heritage Foundation event on Project 2025, which I also think is a big story.
So you missed it.
I was there. I'd actually had made it back. I think I'd made it back to my room in time, because that speech was kind of late in the evening. So I think I made it back to the room and actually saw it on TV. So I did see his speech. And, they had a bunch of these like one-off speakers who were, people you wouldn't expect would support Donald Trump. Here's the union president. Here's Amber Rose, the social media influencer. Here's this wrestling guy or this music guy. And it was all just very disconnected, I think, from the rest of it. Like I was telling you, that the day that O'Brien from the Teamsters spoke, I'd spent the whole day at this Heritage Foundation event where they were pushing the ideas behind Project 2025, which, among other things, is this rapidly anti-union document. Yep. And this is the real blueprint for the Trump administration, not whatever Sean O'Brien and those folks were saying on the stage. We know that Donald Trump is getting votes from union workers. You know that well. But it's not because of his labor policies, that's for sure. It's because of the other stuff, you know, the resentment, the racial politics, the other things that appeal to social issues that, you know, connect with some union worker types.
No, I think the National Review was spot on. And I rarely quote the National Review, but they said, look, yeah. you know, Trump's appeal to union workers is cultural. It's not ideological.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah,
and that's, you know, exactly what you were saying. They agree with. So I tend to believe that's kind of it. But you know, let's go back to what you were talking about a second ago, because, you know, the messaging has been Joe's feeble. Everything's Joe's fault. It's a hellscape out there. Cities are burning. Everyone's under attack. Crime is running rampant. It's this alternative narrative, this alternative reality and narrative that they've created and they keep reinforcing. Because if you watch that convention, you would think literally the country was burning and everyone was cowering in the corners of their home. Now what do they do now that Biden's not there? You know, it's like I said yesterday, what's the guy who has a warehouse full of Let's Go Brandon t-shirts going to do? Because nobody cares about that anymore. Any thoughts?
Yeah. Yeah. I saw some good stuff on Twitter about people with the F Joe Biden t-shirts. You know, they're out of business now. Right. But I would say two things about that. I mean, we can't pretend that they're going to say nothing about Kamala Harris. The one thing, you know, they're obsessed with the border. They claim that, you know, they kind of deliberately misinterpret what her role was in the Biden administration. You know, in the early years of the Biden administration, she was basically the emissary to these Central American countries that were trying to work with and trying to help them fix their problems. So not so many people leave and make this dangerous journey to come up here. And that's an impossible job. And she wasn't particularly successful at it because frankly, nobody would be right. But because of that, you know, they call her the border czar. Right. And I heard that even when they thought Biden was the candidate at the convention, you know, they were still, when her name came up, it was to like deride her as quote, the border czar. So, you know, they're going to make a big deal about that, which, you know, getting to your original point is a little bit silly at this point, because we now know that, you know, we now see that border crossings have plummeted to their lowest level, you know, to levels at or below what when Trump was president at this point, you know. So maybe their border policies, and I don't agree with all, I don't want to go off on a digression, but I personally don't agree with some of their border policies. But in terms of the goal of reducing the number of people crossing into the country without documents, it is succeeding in achieving that goal, right? So they're still going to go with that. There's no question. But to your bigger point, I mean, you know, it was clear spending the week in Milwaukee that their whole campaign was geared towards this contrast between Trump and Biden, and a lot of what they were trying to do. You know, there was so much talk about the strength. I mean, I heard the word strength or some variation of it, you know, so many times, or weakness, you know, in reference to Biden, right? And the whole thing for these guys was the contrast between the supposedly strong Donald Trump, you know, which is, you know, mostly a myth, but that's their myth that they've created, you know, against this weak, feeble Joe Biden, you know, because you know, they appeal to a certain kind of voter who has a very kind of raw version of what they think strength is all about, you know, that it's something that's projected, that it's a kind of, you know, macho of toughness, you know. I mean so much of Trump's shtick nowadays is taken from like Ultimate Fighting and his previous past with you know, the WWE, right. and pro wrestling. You know, I mean, you know, the way he acted after the assassination attempt in Pennsylvania looked like some kind of Ultimate Fighting gimmick, right? You know, getting up and...
No, I got to tell you, though, you know, to be honest, Will, you know, you watch that video, you can see the wheels in his head turning. How do I use this for my advantage? You could see him gather himself and make, you know, I got to do this. And look, you know, you even got the Teamsters president going, he's one tough SOB. So it does play into that, what you've said. And there's a difference between, in my view, being tough and being a bully.
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly make exactly. And you can certainly make the argument that, you know, what Joe Biden did yesterday, you know, and it, I mean, he had all the cards, right? I mean, all the delegates are, you know, 90% of the delegates going to Chicago were pledged to him. And he could put his foot down and say, you know, and give some kind of West Wing type speech about I'm the president and I'm not backing down. And he could have not released his delegates and gone to Chicago or had this virtual roll call or whatever they're going to do and forced his rammed his way through the nomination. And, somebody who's kind of a strongman type like Donald Trump would probably do, you know, I mean, we saw the lengths that Trump went to in 2020 and 2021 to try and keep himself in office. I mean, Biden didn't have to do that. He just could have said, I'm sticking in the race. I'm not releasing my delegates. And, you know, he was strong enough to say, look, you know, I got into this thing to stop Donald Trump. My instincts were right in 2020 that by running, I could be maybe the only person who could defeat Trump. We'll never know if anybody else could, but it seems like that might have been true, you know, what he said in 2020. And now it's 2024 and things have changed. You know, he's, you know, for you know, we could do a whole show talking about the reasons why, but I mean, he certainly has a low approval rating, undeserved in my opinion. But,
and look, everybody saw what happened on that Thursday. And that's what made me go, look, you lose confidence. If the American people don't have confidence that you can deliver the punchline, at least you've got to pass the torch. That's for me was that moment. And I said at the time, he's going to do the right thing. I believe in my heart of hearts that Joe Biden will put country first and do the right thing. And he ultimately did. I don't have that faith in Donald Trump whatsoever. So I guess last line of questioning I got for you, because he did release the delegates. It looks like all the machinery is heading towards Kamala. Any chance that doesn't happen? Do we go into a convention where there's some chaos? I know Obama has called for an open convention. Any thoughts?
Yeah, no, there's not going to be an open convention. I mean, for one thing, you know, it's one thing if the delegates are free to vote their conscience, but to vote for somebody else, there has to be other candidates, you know, and there are no other candidates. Yeah. You know, all the people who would be credible candidates, you know, even people with bad intentions like Joe Manchin, who's, I mean, it's hard to believe he would even say anything. He's not even a Democrat anymore. But, right?
You find as funny as I do that there are people out there who want, no, there's nobody out there who wants Joe Manchin other than Joe Manchin.
Yeah, I don't even know. He wouldn't even win the West Virginia delegation, right, if he ran. So it's really pathetic. But even he saw how ridiculous it would have been to try and run against really what's become kind of a juggernaut in a way. And I'm not being facetious, you know. It's interesting because, you know, after all these weeks of speculation about, oh, well, maybe this is the big chance for Gretchen Whitmer or, you know, Josh Shapiro or whoever. And, you know, so many trees were killed to write these columns, you know, speculating about all these people who could go in there and, oh, it could be really messy. And, you know, the Democrats, they always fight. And, you know, it went down in like 6 hours and it was like nothing like that.
So
I mean, it was just,
you brought up Shapiro. You think he's got a shot at being VP?
He does, I think, because I don't know if he's the front runner, but I think he's definitely got a shot because, I mean, let's face it. I mean, the Democrats can't win this election without Pennsylvania. And for whatever reasons, and I live here and I don't fully understand it, but for some reason in Pennsylvania, he's been underperforming even some of the other swing states, right? So he needs, slip after all the changes. She, Kamala Harris, you know, needs, you know, some kind of lightning bolt, I think, to win, to make sure she wins Pennsylvania. And Josh Shapiro, extremely popular. He's even fairly popular among, you know, whatever moderate Republicans are left, you know, like Josh Shapiro. So, he'd be a super strong candidate. I mean, I think Andy Beshear has the best overall profile, you know, but he's not from a swing state. So I don't know. I think those are two of the strongest. I do think Mark Kelly is also a strong candidate. He is from a swing state. You know, he's an astronaut. I mean, this whole strength macho thing, you know, why not put an astronaut in there, right? So
there you go. I keep going back to, I like Pete Buttigieg only for a debate with JD Vance. That's all. That's where my mind goes, because I think he's such a great debater that would be a great
event. That would be must-see TV. You know, I think JD would be in tears at the end, and wouldn't we love to see that?
There you go. Will, as always, great stuff. Appreciate the time.
Yeah, Rick, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
As always, our good friend Will Bunch, national columnist there at the Philadelphia Inquirer. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Who you putting money on for VP? Is it going to be Josh Shapiro or Bashir or Mark Kelly? Or do you want to see the debate like I do? Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for Up North News Radio.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy, slight shower chance tonight, low upper 50s to 60. Mostly sunny for tomorrow after some patchy morning fog, highs in the upper 70s. Sunshine in around 80 to the low 80s Thursday, and with more humidity for the weekend, temps continue to climb through the 80s. Currently, it's 66.
The Todd Alba Show.
Reed Galen, co-founder of the Lincoln Project on Project 2025.
Donald Trump, Mr. Vance, when you say mass deportation, what do those words actually mean? Tell me how you're going to identify those people. Tell me where you're going to put those people. Something like a mass deportation suddenly becomes a massive forced roundup of people who maybe have been here 6 months and maybe have been here 60 years.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we're looking back at the really low energy, low topic, I mean, the RNC convention was, I don't know, it wasn't what I was expecting. It was a lot of political theater, a lot of the sky's falling, doom, gloom, all kind of stuff. But I thought it could have been much more focused. I know they're trying to reach out to working people and pretend like they care. It didn't really land. But I did find something in their platform that I go, yeah, should have done this years ago. Probably should have never done it in the first place. But according to the platform, the RNC, they're calling for an end to most favored nation status for China. Something, again, I've been in favor of getting rid of for a very long time. But the question is will they actually get it done, especially when you've got Donald Trump, who thinks he's Mr. Art of the Deal, and then, again, reiterated this fantasy that he forced them to buy all of this stuff. How's that going to play out? And is this an opportunity for nonpartisanship? And here to share some thoughts on this topic and maybe where we go with it, I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, great to be with you.
So let's start with the RNC. Any thoughts, any gut reaction to what we saw, or did you not watch it?
I watched a lot of other things.
Okay.
You raised the one trade issue where we're all aligned. And I think this is important. And this is the point that I would make is that there are going to be a lot of issues where, you know, whose side are you on, and kind of like, you know, the working class or big corporations, where there's going to be a real open question. And in some aspects of trade policy, there will be. But one thing that I think is undeniable, and this has happened in both parties, I want to say, not just the Republicans, but the Democrats as well, is this idea that we can just do unfettered free trade with whoever, I think has been put in the dumpster.
I hope so.
I don't know if the lock and key are there yet, but it's definitely in the dumpster. And that that policy platform to revoke PNTR, which is permanent normal trade relations, or the old parlance, which is most favored nation status for China, which gives it really low tariff access into the U.S. market, is a good indication of that. I would say the interesting thing is right now, the House of Representatives, which obviously is under, you know, Republican control, could pass a bill to do that. The Select Committee on China made this recommendation about a year ago. Well, not quite a year ago, but some time ago. And I offered this actually as a recommendation a long time ago, like you, Rick. I was an OG on this. And so this isn't a new idea, but this is one thing I'm glad to see the party platform folks embrace. I have to believe that a lot of the big multinational corporate folks who were there were kind of like plugging their nose when some of this was discussed. And I know we'll get to this, but, you know, the Trump's first term had a very mixed record on China. Right. And so
No, let me ask you this, because, you know, you said that the big corporations were holding their nose. My theory on this is very different. Look, working people have been against this bad idea for a very long time because they're the ones who are taking it on the chin. Obviously, yeah. As factories are closing and moving overseas, because, again, we didn't lose the jobs. We know where they are. They're over there.
Correct.
So as working people were losing them, obviously they were against losing them, thus the working class being opposed to these bad trade deals. But corporate America was all on board, all in favor, going, yeah, more profit for us. I see this as a little different, where the turn now, especially for Republicans, and maybe you'll agree or you won't, but I see this as corporate America is starting to take it on the chin, because the Chinese are saying, well, we got our own stuff now. Yeah, we stole yours, or you gave us yours. We don't need you anymore. So this seems to me to be corporate America going, hey, how about coming and helping us and saving us? So I see it a little differently.
Yeah, there is some truth to that. And there's certainly some companies that have been burnt, and they do have a stronger view on this. There's still way too many. And you look at our, you know, we still have a big trade deficit with China. It's come down a little bit, but it's massive. It's the biggest that we have, although Mexico's catching up. And so there's still a lot of companies that depend on imports coming from China. You think about Walmart or Amazon, you think about Apple. And yeah, they do have somewhat of a, you know, there is a mixed experience now. But I do think those companies still drive a lot of profits from the types of contract manufacturing and other things that they're pulling out of China right now, Rick.
Yeah, no, I mean, at the end of this, the reality is something has to be done, because, you know, as we've been talking about for years, Scott, and you've been on this show for years, and we've been saying the same thing over and over, waiting for our elected officials to catch up and to actually do something. So I'm thrilled that the RNC has added this into their platform. My problem is I then look at the Project 2025 paperwork, and they're still talking about, yeah, we need free trade agreements, and we don't need that trade adjustment assistance in there. Just treat those like regular job losses. So it seems like there's a part going, yeah, we still want these bad free trade agreements, maybe just not with China.
Yeah. Well, and I think that is true, and that's always going to be kind of the battle for the heart and soul of that party, right? And I think there's inherent conflict there. I'm just going to say they're not alone.
No, they're not.
Certainly case in the Democratic Party, but it is alive and well. And let's just kind of lay it out here, because I think that, you know, one side will look at Donald Trump and say he was horrible on China. Another side will look at Donald Trump and say he was the best we've ever had on China. And the truth is, like, he did some things and he didn't do some things, right? I mean, he did put tariffs on steel. That was good. He put tariffs on aluminum. That was good. He put tariffs on some other products. That was good. He stopped putting tariffs on because he had a deal with China because he said they agreed to buy, you know, tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars of worth of American products. And that literally never happened. I mean, there was no deal that China kept, but he stopped putting the tariffs on once he got that deal. He was for banning TikTok. Now he's against it, it seems, right? You know, he announced with a big flourish this foreign investment coming into the United States, the form of this big Foxconn factory in Wisconsin that literally never materialized at all. It's a glorified warehouse that employs very few people.
But he got the photo op, and that's all that matters.
Yeah. And even on the tariff amounts, he said 60%. He said, well, I meant to say, you know, 50% won't necessarily be that. And so it's not, you know, there's going to be a China policy. You just don't know what it's going to be. And then saying Taiwan needs to do more. And so there, I do think that I don't think that any, you know, kind of like objective observer could look at and say, Trump's going to be tougher on China than, like, say, a Harris administration, or that Biden was. In fact, I think you can make the argument in a lot of ways the sanctions that the Biden-Harris administration put on a lot of the Chinese firms and semiconductors have eviscerated, absolutely eviscerated, that industry, and they're reeling from that. And so, and then they put big tariffs, you know, 100% tariffs on Chinese EVs and other things like that. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm happy when there's a competition of ideas to see who can do more on China. But I think all of your listeners need to, you know, if they're the MAGA types or whatever, they just need to look at this objectively to say, you know, there's some stuff that he did, there's some stuff that he didn't do.
Right.
And there's some stuff that the current president did really well. And there's some stuff that they still need to do as well.
No, look, I give Trump credit for making the issue front and center. I keep saying in 2016, Trump stole Bernie Sanders' message and sadly didn't do enough on it. But there's this idea, and I guess we just have, as Americans, have short-term memories or historic amnesia, because this tariff discussion, there are a lot of people who think this is new. This is just a Trump-Biden thing. And reality, no, this has been around a while.
Yeah, it has been. Just no one is in power to do anything about it. I think that's the difference, right, is because there was always, and I know because I was a part of this, you know, there were always kind of like pro-worker Democrats who had a really powerful message on this. They just did not have a majority. But they were out in front on this stuff before anybody else. And I have the receipts to prove it. I have all the anti-NAFTA buttons. I have the no blank check for China, you know, no fast track, all of that stuff. And so there was a sizable group, but unfortunately they were overwhelmed by the combination of virtually every Republican at the time, And unfortunately, a lot of Democrats, too. Yeah. So
no.
As someone wise once say, buy how the turntables. And I know I mangled that on purpose. But yeah, it's, you know, but it is shifted quite a bit, right?
But here's the thing. I mean, I look at this just this week, I guess, a new report from the WTO has come out looking at China. And, you know, the bottom line is, surprise, surprise, they lack transparency. And we knew that without the report. But again, this is another one of those things where someone's, you know, spending time looking at this stuff, because we were told if we trade with them, they're going to open up. They're going to become a lot more like us. They're going to buy our stuff. It's going to be this kumbaya kind of cross-border trading kind of thing. Going to make everybody rich. Sad reality, we've lost millions of jobs. Communities have been screwed up. Drug problems are through the roof. A lot of the negatives we got a lot of. But the benefits, I would argue, just cheap stuff for a short period of time, I don't know that's enough.
It's not enough. And it does have lasting impacts on our wages, on our communities, on our ability to innovate, on having resilient supply chains. And so when there is some sort of a disruption, that we're not in complete and total chaos like we have been the last couple of times. And And it's really interesting because the WTO issues this in, and it does this every year, that looks at how transparent countries are about the subsidies and their compliance with WTO rules. And with China, it's forever a bad report. It's just how bad and how candid they are about it. And so yeah, I mean, this is backsliding, and it just shows that it's even hard to quantify how much the Chinese Communist Party supports its manufacturing base to want to dominate the world. And you know, again, it's fine to have an industrial policy, but when you have an industrial policy where the goal is to wipe out all your other competition, that is not okay. And that's the difference between what the United States is trying to do and what China has done for a couple of decades.
But isn't that capitalism, Scott? Isn't that the whole, you know, whether it's communist version of capitalism or a democratic version of capitalism, yeah. Isn't it to be the big fish always eats the little fish?
So funny that you say that, because this literally has nothing to do with efficiency, right? What China is doing here. They are, in fact, making up for inefficiency. And so if it were a truly transparent and totally free market, there'd be a different set of circumstances. But, you know, the Chinese companies, with the help of the government, they have to do a whole lot of other stuff to try to get that China price, which is so impossible to attain. And so, you know, China just completed one of these meetings it does every 5 years, the Chinese Communist Party did. And it basically reaffirmed the same old stuff. Like, we're going to continue to do, you know, industrial policy stuff in our manufacturing sector that is very mercantilist, that's going to be upsetting the world order on this. And again, it's not because the Chinese firms are more efficient, more agile, or more innovative necessarily, although I don't want to discredit some of the work that those firms have done. But in every case, there's a massive subsidy that they get. And there's also a goal that the government has, again, to wipe out their competition globally. And so that's, yeah, they are clearly not complying with the terms under which they entered the World Trade Organization.
No, which is why, you know, you hit on a point that I've stopped calling it all cheap plastic garbage that comes from China, because they have now reached a point, because they have the manufacturing, they've got people who do some tinkering and some different ideas, to where now they're innovating at a lot faster pace than they ever have before. And I fear, you know, the thing that we were supposed to be the best at, you know, this idea of innovation, creating the next great products and the next great everything, that we're losing some of that advantage while they're gaining it, simply because they have the manufacturing base.
Right. Yeah, case after case, and you just set this up perfectly. Solar, we invent the technology, we do the innovation. China has somewhere between 80 and 90% of the global market now. Drones, you know, we have all sorts of whiz-bang cool stuff that we can show that the Defense Advanced Research Project agency can do, and all these other NASA and all this other stuff. China has like 90% of the world drone market, you know, and so it's in industry after industry, this is totally the case where we've done the innovation, we've done the amazing design, and then yeah, the technology has been transferred to China, it's been scaled up, and all of our efforts have been wiped out, and we have to start from scratch. And that's not a sustainable model. We got it. That, which is why I'm glad we are putting our foot down in a number of these issue industries like semiconductors.
No, it's great. Look, this administration, in my view, again, you don't have to come along for this, has turned the corner and has been transformational in having something of an industrial policy that's going to put us on the right track so we reshore some of this stuff and save some of the jobs we already have, which gives me to pivot to this story about this Cleveland Cliffs in West Virginia, which was supposed to, you know, close down a tin mill, but now is being repurposed. Tell me the story here.
Yeah. So first, the bad news, which was that, you know, things are still rough in the global metal trades. And so the tin industry in the United States have been devastated by imports, and Cleveland-Cliffs needed to lay off, unfortunately, an indefinitely idle a tin mill in West Virginia. You think you'd want the ability to make cans? Did we learn nothing from this pandemic, Rick? I mean, man, but no, we did not have the tariff support that we needed. But to its great credit, I think Cliffs, the steelworkers, some local officials worked out a plan where they can build transformers there. And there's a massive demand for transformers. And because of some rules that people like Senator Sherrod Brown pushed for, you know, a lot of that material has to be made in the United States. And so it created a new market. And this is the perfect example of what we call market shaping. Yep. And Cliffs is going to take advantage of that, is going to put people back to work. 600 steelworker jobs in the panhandle of West Virginia. I mean, if you ever thought that a new steel or metal facility would be opening up in that valley, really? I mean, would anyone ever imagine that? And so it's really cool to see that. But yeah, that just happened, July 22nd. You know, it's a great thing. I'm excited about it.
Well, you know, sound policy, smart investment. This is what you get out of it. Finally, the Olympics are coming up. About ready to kick off, I guess, this week, is it? And some American-made gear going to be on display?
Yeah, Rick, I know you're there for the break dancing and for the synchronized swimming, so you'll be watching along with me. I love the Olympics, I'm going to admit it. But the really cool thing about this is someone, you know, made a mistake, like 5 or 6 Olympics ago, Ralph Lauren, where he outfitted our athletes for the opening and closing ceremonies in some of the attire that was made in China. And he got hammered.
As he should.
He got called out, and we called him out, and officials called him out, Democrats and Republicans. I would say to his great and everlasting credit, he's like, I'm never going to do that again. And so their outfits, and they're representing the United States. So LeBron James, you know, when he's holding that flag, is going to be from head to toe wearing fully made in America garments, shoes from Maine, a belt from Oregon, I think, a beautiful spiffy jacket that's made by a company that also makes military uniforms, the dress uniforms in New York. And the list goes on and on. And we have it on our website. But it is such a great story about how you can invest in the United States. You can look good while doing it, and they're going to be representing our country. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm just hoping the men's basketball team looks a lot better than they did against South Sudan in the warm-up.
I'm confident of that fact, or else I'm sure there'll be repercussions, but I'm pretty psyched to see the whole game.
Right? There you go. Good stuff. Scott, as always, appreciate the time.
All right, Rick. Thanks so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Our good friend Scott Paul. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. You going to watch the Olympics? Going to check out the duds? Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1877. That was the day that a mob began an attack on Chinese workers in San Francisco that killed 4 people. During the mid-1870s, a depression swept across the nation. White workers from the East Coast headed west, many to San Francisco, hoping to find a job. Skilled Chinese workers who had completed their labor on the Transcontinental Railroad also came to the city. There, the Chinese laborers found work in trades like cigar making and also open laundries. Resentment against the Chinese workers grew in the city's white working class. In the summer of 1877, workers on the East Coast railroads walked off their jobs after their wages were cut repeatedly. A wave of labor militancy washed over the nation. Historians often refer to that summer as the Great Upheaval, a time where capital and labor literally battled in the streets. In San Francisco, the Working Men's Association, a socialist workers' organization, called for a rally in front of City Hall. The meeting began with speeches against the titans of capital. But soon, a group of angry workers began to demand speakers, quote, talk about the Chinese. A mob stormed off to terrorize Chinese residents. They burned 20 Chinese laundries. After the violence ended the next day, the anti-Chinese rhetoric continued. An Irish-born freight handler by the name of Dennis Kearney became the vocal leader of the call that the Chinese must go. adherence to the anti-Chinese cause came to be known as Kearneyism. The backlash against Chinese workers spread beyond California. In 1882, Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act. Solidarity of workers had fallen to racism. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. I know I said at the beginning it was $100 million in the first 24 hours. Actually, the big donor money bomb, $150 million in commitments over the first 24 hours, which that's kind of a big freaking deal. Also, we're seeing endorsements lining up behind Kamala Harris, the AFL-CIO, AFT. A number of others have thrown their support behind her. So going to be interesting to see if Joe Manchin can, I can't even believe I'm going to say that. If Joe Manchin can, you know, get a supporter. One, now we're seeing a surge in volunteers, according to the Biden folks. About 28,000 people have signed up to volunteer since President Biden stepped aside. That, again, that energy that I talked about earlier, kind of a big freaking deal, where you're getting 28,000 people going, hey, yeah, let's get this going. Now, for me, I look at, you know, the sad reality is the other side, they're reeling. The Trump campaign, not a clue what they're going to do at this point. But, you know, threats and intimidation always seem to work. Ohio State Senator George Lang was quoted in the Washington Post at a rally for J.D. Vance, actually introduced J.D. Vance. He said, I'm afraid if we lose this one, it's going to take a civil war to save the country, and it will be saved. And it's that kind of talk of violence that, I don't know, I think may have contributed to their top of the ticket getting some shots thrown at him. And do you find it as interesting as I do that you don't hear much about the actual assassination attempt, since it was a Republican who all indications lean towards a conservative Republican? And again, I wish no harm to anyone, but it is interesting how our media plays with that. Now me, look, I'm hoping on this issue, nonpartisan, hoping we all want our politicians to be safe, to not have to worry about some kind of craziness going on. But that comes back to us. Also, I'd love to see both sides come together on some of the issues that I think really do affect working people, and where I do give Sean O'Brien some credit going into the RNC and pointing out that there are problems in the workplace. Maybe someone will have heard it. I don't know. I doubt it, but maybe. But I look at last week, Bernie Sanders, chairman of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee, they issued a report where they looked at 2019 and Prime Day. And what they came out with for 2019 Prime Day is the injury rates for those days, those couple of days, 45 injuries out of 100 workers. That means just those days, you had 45 people go to work out of 100 and not go home in the same condition they showed up to work in. Now they're saying, look, you know, this is in addition to the recordable injuries that OSHA has shown. What the industrial average evidently is for injuries in the workplace, 10 out of 100. Now you go, 45 seems crazy. And look, it's because of the pace. It's because of we got to be customer obsessed. So that means, you know, work through your breaks, you know, work through your bathroom breaks, you know, all of that, you know, don't worry about ergonomics. Just get it done. Now, this is a company that made, what, $36 billion profit last year? Their CEO pocketed, you know, what, $275 million over the past couple of years? And yet their workers are disposable. That's the reality. Now, according to the report, what they want is I think what all of us want, you know, more realistic delivery dates so that you don't have these kind of pressures that make work safer. Maybe we should be talking about that more instead of, you know, the stuff that really tears us apart. Just my thought. I want to hear yours. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. And make sure you check out freespeech.org for our video content. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com.
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM. W248DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.